and paused on the tray. He was staring at her.
So, what are you going to do in October when this place closes?
I won't be here then, she said.
Where are you going to be?
He stepped up beside her at the sink.
College. I'm going to UVM.
Just saying it was a release.
Oh, college. UVM.
In the moment's quiet, she heard him swallow.
Yeah, I know where that is. Burlington.
Burlington. And that was probably all he knew, she thought, feeling more confident than she had in weeks. He took a deep breath.
So, when are you going?
In a month.
She turned on the hot water, grateful for the steam billowing up from the deep, gritty sink.
A month? Wow, that's not very long, is it?
I'm just counting the days. I can't wait,
she said with such forced exuberance that she was ashamed. She felt as if she'd just been bragging.
Well, that's about when I'll be leaving, too. Probably right about that same time. In a month or so, right around then.
He kept clearing his throat.
You're not looking forward to it, I guess, huh?
She asked, confused by the unhappy eyes over his broad, toothy smile.
Oh, no, I love the Marines. That's my whole life, the Corps,
he said, his stance oddly rigid, his chin raised, gaze fixed.
There's nothing else I want to do, nothing.
He looked down at her.
So I know what you mean about counting the days. Believe me, I know.
Yeah, well, it won't be long now,
she said, sighing.
Sure won't,
he agreed, with a hollow laugh. She turned the water off and stacked the trays, banging them noisily together, then reached under the sink and dragged out the metal carton of disinfectant bottles. He began to wipe the stainless steel hood above the grill, reaching high over his head, straining and grunting, while she bent close to the countertop she was scrubbing. It seemed that they were both trying to work their way back from some fragile precipice. In winter, the restaurant's knotty pine walls, red-tiled floor, and cavernous stone fireplace provided a cozy spot for skiers, but on this summer night the dining room was almost empty, and the dusty hearth reeked of creosote and damp ashes. The Killington view was on the access road up the mountain, so no one from town would see them here. Omar had been hoping that dinner out might placate Bernadette, but at the moment she was threatening to call the police if he didn't give her back her $100. She had just found out that her fiancé's parole hearing would be at the end of the month, and she needed the money for her wedding.
I don't give a shit how many fucking contracts you say I fucking signed.
Shh. I don't either, Bernie. I mean, if it was just me, I'd rip them up and write it off to unforeseen circumstances.
He stirred his drink.
But it's not just me. It's the whole Gold Mine Enterprises empire you have contracted with.
No, I keep trying to tell you. Nothing counts. Nothing I sign, nothing I say, nothing I do.
Come again,
he said, with a long, cool sip that choked him when she answered.
I'm underage.
Precisely my point,
he wheezed, his mind racing as he cleared his throat.
You are so young, so inexperienced, so untested. You think it's all got to happen now. Slow down. Be patient so you can have the kind of life you really want, and not the kind of life that's always being patched up and put back together. You are a top-of-the-line lady, so stop settling for second-hand all the time and second-best. It's time to show people in this town just how classy you can be.
Time, that's all it took, he tried to explain. Time, patience, and the determination to get her business started, and then she'd be able to have a dream wedding. Her eyes glowed brighter than the wagon wheel of amber lights above them. He patted his breast pocket.
Sure, I could get you off my back and give this to you right now, but I'm not going to be the one to dash those dreams, not when I'm sitting here picturing you in one of them 20-foot-long satin trains that Mary and Noel each have a hold of, and this lacy kind of veil floating all around your pretty face,
he said, swirling his hands around his own head as she began to smile.
Can you imagine those two little angels in their own sweet little flower girl dresses, all poofy with crinolines and rosebuds in their hair? I can. That's what I see for you. So don't you go settling for some mousy little suit and hangdog hat that says, I made two mistakes and now I gotta pay by slinking into some J.P.'s ratty front parlor and hide my God-given moment of triumph to do it in private like it's some kind of dirty thing. No, sir. You be patient and you do it right and you do it big, proud, like you should, like you deserve. He said, stabbing the tabletop so hard his finger would ache all the next day. All you gotta do is wait a bit, he pleaded. Just wait for the soap to come. There was silence in the few moments before they both began to eat again. Well, maybe he was right, she said, chewing and gesturing with her fork as she spoke. She was so sick of being treated like dirt, people thinking they could say anything they wanted to her. She looked at him, recalling the V.D. inspector at her door. He tried to explain how it had been a tasteless practical joke played on him by this horny fellow.
Played on you?
She gasped, beginning to choke on the chunk of beef she had been chewing. Her face reddened as she gagged. She squeezed her throat. Should have ordered rare, he thought, already a leap ahead to the deposition, the testimony. Hadn't he told her? Hadn't he said never order well in a two-bit place like that? Always ordered down from what you really want in degrees of doneness, always. But the young never listen, do they? Of course, on you, too, he said, leaning to peer into her stricken eyes. Just a momentary spasm here, that was all. But if something were to happen, if this was her time, then so be it. Then the investment was meant to be his, free and clear. He patted her fists, gently harnessing them from banging the table again. Especially on you, more than anyone, dear, who had to endure the vile and reprehensible questions. Are you all right? Her lips were blue and her nose leaked. She pulled free and stuck her finger down her throat. She gagged and the gray plug of beef shot onto the table with a disappointing little thud. She held her head, gasping for breath. Such a tiny piece, he thought, observing the few diners who had no inkling what had nearly transpired. Imagine, just a wedge thicker and how different the mood would be. My lord, my lord, my lord, he sighed as he wet his napkin and patted her sweaty face. Look at this, he murmured. You're so tense, every vein in your temple's just popping in and out.
I was choking, she said in a raspy, accusing voice.
Well, I thought things were getting a little strange. But you've been so damned emotional all night long, I was confused. He looked at her closely. You okay? She nodded. You sure? Can you talk? He took her hand and squinted at the wink of light that was her engagement ring. I've missed you.
There was a stir in his belly.
What about that lady, that Mrs. Vermoyle? She asked, closing her fingers over his.
That's something else. That's business. But this. This here's a powerful and natural attraction, he said.
She pulled her hand away and looked at him.
So, when's the soap coming?
Any day now, he said,
probing his ear dreamily with a toothpick as Bernadette began to eat her cherry cheesecake. Her nose was still running. Goldmine Enterprises had promised delivery sometime in the next 2 weeks. Nothing to worry about, they had assured him when he called. The soap would be a sure thing. Nothing like the lousy magazines, tramping all over New England with his sorry crew, whining every second for Hamburgs, cigarettes, hemorrhoid ointment, and rubbers. And then the kicker was the goddamn Bibles he thought he was getting such a deal on to use for a bonus if the pinch-faced little housewife would only buy 3 different subscriptions from the Negroes she let into her front hall, and then didn't know how the hell to get rid of without hurting their feelings, or worse, having them think she was prejudiced, and that it had anything to do with the color of their skin. Half the pages were blank inside the goddamn Bibles, all bound up in different color fake leather covers with raised gold lettering, so he had to go spend even more money on clear plastic sheeting and tape to seal each one so he'd be long gone before they were opened. The damn Negroes loved it. 2 whole days spent in a motel room covering them while they watched TV, drinking beer and eating pretzels, with Montague at him every minute, trying to figure out what was going on, demanding to know why the others had to cover the Bibles. So they wouldn't get soiled, so they wouldn't get creased, to keep them like new, he explained, over and over to the old man who was almost totally blind, another of fate's lousy pitches. In a million years he wouldn't have taken Montague Peace along had he known the old man was about blind as a bat. He had been eager to sign on early, who was tall and well-spoken with a disarming boyish grin. But then Montague raised such a stink about the boy being his only living relative, and it was the night before they were to leave, and Luther alone was useless to him, and he just got too tired and worn down to argue any more. Careless, actually, thinking maybe they'd just lose him along the way, or maybe he'd die. But then the opposite started to happen. The old man just got stronger with all the traveling, happier, and more determined to keep up and do his part, which was to be led onto those icy porches so he could tell the scared little lady of the house how the profit from each subscription sale went to build rest homes for blind and infirm old colored folks down in the terrible boiling South, where no such homes were now available to them. Montague would start quoting from the Bible, his belief in the mission growing as real to him as his responsibility to it. The irony was that it came to be Montague who talked early out of it every time he threatened to quit and head down home to Lady Dwelly. The old man finally had a purpose.
"One more week," he'd coax his lovesick grandson. "Just this next town."
Omar's mistake was he started losing interest, and then he kept getting more and more careless until it all turned on him, a bloodthirsty monster of his own creation. "No," he told himself, "what's done is done. Damned if he'd ever get involved in anything like that again. No, sir, this was sure fire, this soap deal. Just cash passing hand over hand, dealerships piling up, multiplying in some sort of unstoppable geometric progression of investments, pushing him up to the top of the heap where he belonged, where he would have been years ago, except for crazy things, snags, flukes like Montague and blank Bibles always tripping him up, getting in his way, holding him back. He'd always considered himself a religious man, a patriot, a man who believed in signs. Men were sent from their creator to this scraggly earth with particular missions stamped indelibly upon their brains and souls. His he knew to be success. Why else had the Lord sent him as a white man to America, when he might just as well have dropped him down in India or Africa or Korea? Each time he stumbled, the Lord picked him up and set him on a new road. And so he figured it was the Lord who had caused the magazine deal to fall through. The Lord had sent Montague and then the lot of damaged Bibles. And when the police brought them in for questioning, missing Omar, who had just stepped into the woods to take a leak, he knew the Lord was stirring the waters again, jiggling him off the hook, because his name was not on a single contract and not on any of the doctored checks carried always between porch and bank in old Montague's pocket. It was the Lord who had trawled him through the sudden spring heat onto that dead-end street into the voracious arms of Marie Fermoil, who needed love and softening, solace and attention like no woman he had ever met. Yes, sir, it was the Lord. The Lord had led him home.
"You want to come back and see how I fixed up the place?"
Bernadette asked as she wiggled out of the booth. She smoothed her skirt over her belly.
"Let me make a call," he said, "an appointment I can reschedule."
And it was the Lord that had given him this mighty appetite. Samuel Fermoil woke up with the drone of air conditioning throbbing in his temples. The clammy sheets trussed his ankles as he tried to curl into a ball. He couldn't stop shivering. He hadn't left this room since Alice's visit, which had depressed the hell out of him. The crumpled papers on the nightstand were all his attempted apologies. "Dear Alice, I'm sorry you had to wait so long. Dear Alice, I'm sorry I kept you waiting so long. Dear Alice, I'm sorry. Dear Alice, as you must now realize, I don't belong here. Dear Alice, every day I get sicker and sicker."
"Not sick now, Mr. Fermoil,"
the nurse had corrected him this morning with a wag of her finger.
"You're just not well."
The difference being, according to Dr. Litchfield, an insidious fixity of negative attitude that overtakes and impairs a life. Therefore, Sam Fermoil was no alcoholic, but a man who needed to control his drinking. not a shiftless, chronically unemployed parasite, just someone in need of a job. And this was not a fucking blinding migraine, but a mass of soft tissue that needed to redirect its energy surges. Pain gripped his skull like a spiked helmet. He groped for the buzzer.
"Help,"
he groaned when the nurse opened the door.
"What seems to be the problem?"
she asked, towering over him, arms bolted across her starched, pleated chest.
"No problem. I'm just having a little stroke here, that's all. Just an exploding artery."
"I'll get Dr. Litchfield. He's on the floor."
She hurried off, and Sam waited, cringing.
"Uh-huh. Up. Now down. Look right. Look left."
The light shining in his eyes had to be probing the roaring depths of hell. Sighing, Litchfield clipped the penlight into his jacket pocket.
"Headache," he said.
The nurse left, then returned with tepid water in a paper cup.
"I have to get out of here, Doc,"
he said as the nurse handed him two pills.
"Before I get really sick." "You had a visitor the other day, Sam. Your first, right?"
Litchfield toyed with his wedding band.
"Right. Your daughter," Litchfield said, nodding. "And how did it go?" "Just great, Doc."
He lay back and closed his eyes.
"We laughed, we danced, we ran through the fields in slow motion. We even sang some hymns together." "Why did it take you almost an hour to get downstairs to her?"
Litchfield asked.
"I was dressing." "You were procrastinating. You didn't really want to see her, did you?" "Maybe I didn't want her to see me looking like one of the screwballs."
He knew where this was headed.
"She made you nervous, didn't she? She made you feel guilty and anxious." "Whatever you say, Doc,"
Sam sighed.
"Look, I'm beat. I want to go to sleep. Like you said, it's a headache, that's all, not a fucking breakdown."
Litchfield smiled.
"That's why you're not ready for release yet, Sam. That's what I've been trying to get across to you. You're treating this like a sentence, the way a prisoner would. You think if you just do your time, your 30 or 60 days, then it goes without saying that you're automatically going to be released."
As Litchfield began to walk around the room, Sam forced himself to sit up a little. He lit a cigarette he didn't want and tried to keep his squinting eyes on Litchfield, who paused to examine the painting over the table, the thermostat setting. He wet his finger and rubbed at a nick on the nightstand.
"It doesn't work that way, Sam. Rehabilitation. That's the only way out of here."
He blew smoke down the length of the bed. At least he had stopped shivering.
"Suicide,"
he said, tapping the ash into his palm.
"You forgot suicide. Dr. LaSalle tells me you've stopped going to group therapy,"
Litchfield said, obviously trying not to lose his temper.
"I couldn't take the shit, Doc. I told you before, I'll knock it around with a few drunks, but I'm not going to spend every afternoon with the crazies. It's humiliating as hell, Doc." "Miss Lynette feels she's made quite an emotional investment in you, and now your absence is a personal affront to her, Sam." "Miss Lynette is a personal affront, Doc, and Miss Lynette can take a flying shit for herself."
He coughed hoarsely. Litchfield's eyes narrowed. Miss Lynette, Sam knew, was a prize patient, a hospital pet, who had managed to turn instability into a calling. She knew all the jargon. She was a group leader. She was LaSalle's right-hand loony.
"Perhaps, Sam, these headaches are merely another manifestation of your frustration and hostility."
Litchfield lowered his voice.
"Miss Lynette says you spit on her in leatherwork."
Sam began to laugh. Raging through his cells was this hysteria that threatened to turn what was a battle with the bottle into a battle for his own sanity. Litchfield's face reddened. He swallowed hard.
"Miss Lynette is one of our best group therapy people. She's been with our sessions for 5 years now, and she's top-notch at spotting hostility and frustration in a patient. But today, she refused to come to therapy, and when Dr. LaSalle went looking for her, he found her hiding in her closet. She said she couldn't stand being spit on by someone she was trying to help."
"I never spit at her,"
Sam groaned, closing his eyes.
"I've never known her to lie, Sam. At least not about another patient. She takes therapy very, very seriously. Then why the hell is she still here after 5 years of it?
He countered, disgusted with himself for continuing this bizarre debate. He knew why. It was all so seductive that here even conflict was safe.
Some patients take longer than others. Even Miss Lynette has a few problems left to resolve,
Litchfield conceded with a nod.
A few problems? One of which is imagining that I like to spit on her. Come on, Litchfield, cut the shit.
Litchfield stared at him.
Sam, what do you think Miss Lynette's problems are?
He came closer.
Really now, in your own opinion. Uh-uh.
He smiled wanly.
I can't come out and play with you, Doc. Sorry. Think about her a minute, Sam. How she picks the skin off her calluses. How she squeezes that wart on her neck until it bleeds. How she's always bumping into tables, knocking her elbows against the walls, tripping when there's nothing to trip over. What does that tell you?
Litchfield's eyes were dancing.
I don't know. How the hell should I know?
He sighed.
Try, Sam. The first thing into your head, whatever it is. She hates herself because she knows what a beast she really is. Who cares?
He added hastily, seeing the eagerness flood Litchfield's eyes.
Exactly, Sam. I knew it, he cried. At long last, I've got a group member who can spot self-negation. You don't know how very valuable you're going to be to me from now on, Sam. You have no idea,
he said through clenched teeth. He patted Sam's shoulder.
Shit,
he sighed.
Tomorrow afternoon we begin,
Litchfield cried.
You know, I haven't had a good self-negation sleuth in, let me see, 6 or 8 months anyway, and it's hurt the groups considerably.
He grinned.
We need you in there pitching strong, Samuel, so you get some sleep now.
After Litchfield left, Sam pulled the pillow over his face. Helen was going to pay for this. He was getting out of here. Alice rushed through her closing chores so she could leave work the minute Father Gannon drove into the lot. Tonight she'd finally get the ordeal of his apology over with. He'd called every morning this week offering her a ride home from work, until she had finally accepted. They were driving down Main Street now. She could tell he was nervous, though he hadn't said a word yet about last Saturday. He was in the middle of some long-involved story about the Holy Name Society's barbecue at the lake. There had been the horseshoe competition, in which he had been pitching a close second until the Monsignor pulled him aside and confided that Jim Quillen had been champion for the last 5 years.
Which I take to mean Jim Quillen's the man to beat.
He chuckled.
So, thinking the Monsignor really wants this one, I bear down and start tossing them meaner and cleaner, and everyone's clapping and cheering me on, and I win by 6 points. And all the way home, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with the Monsignor. How come he's not talking to me? How come every time I say anything, he just grunts? And then, right as we pull into the driveway, I happen to mention the rattle in the engine, and that's when he tells me. Better get used to it, he says, since it's Quillen who provides the rectory with a new car every 2 years. Apparently, the horseshoe event is the little man's big claim to fame.
He looked over and grinned.
I seem to be the Monsignor's worst fears come true, a fool in priest's clothing.
His bitter laughter made her squirm. She forced a smile. Why couldn't he just apologize and be done with it? Her neck ached with the long, strained silence. Father Gannon sighed.
So,
he said, then sighed again. He turned down the next street and pulled in front of a house that belonged to a girl in her class. She wished he'd say what he had to and be done with it. He turned off the motor.
So,
he said, taking a deep breath in the sudden silence. She tried to focus on the stars beyond the dark trees because this was going to get really weird. There were millions of stars up there, and all the millions and millions of brilliant stars were dead, and she didn't understand any of it, and her stomach was growling, and he kept clearing his throat. Oh, God, this was going to be even worse than she'd thought. As he began to speak, he ran his hands over the steering wheel. He recentered the magnetic crucifix on the dashboard.
Anyway, what I really have to say, I mean, what I want to say... Well, actually, you see,
I can't stand the thought of you, that is, the possibility of you being in any way damaged. No, that's not the right word. Disillusioned, that's it. Disillusioned by my poor judgment. And so I think it's important that I explain things. Well, myself, that is. I mean, about being a priest. Well, of course, you know about that generally, but I mean about myself and what being a priest has been like. Not the whole vocation. I don't mean that. I mean me.
That's okay. You don't have to, really.
The story of his vocation was the last thing on earth she wanted to hear. No, you see, I don't want you thinking badly of all priests or being confused about your faith or the church because of me, because of what I did. You know what I mean?
The more she assured him that none of this was necessary, the more determined he was to explain. He was telling her about his family. His father had been a janitor in their parish grammar school, working for little money all his life, drinking too much on weekends and holidays, shaming his mother and older sister, both devout churchgoers. All his life his mother had wanted him to be a priest.
"From the day I was born, according to my father," he said, making himself sound uniquely chosen. "She would tell me all she wanted in life was to see her son a priest. And I'll tell you the truth. For a long time, it wasn't even near what I wanted. I loved sports and girls and hanging out and going to the movies and playing cards. But I wanted to go to college, and I really wanted to help people, you know, with their problems, with their lives. It was this thing, this real need I had. Nothing made me feel as good as when I was helping someone. And so at that point in my life, it all kind of came together. College, my mother wanting me to be a priest, me wanting her to be proud as much as I needed to be a good person and help people."
His head was back against the headrest, and she wondered if his eyes were closed. He was explaining that his desire to help people had always been a stronger motivation than any deep and mystical love of God. He sat up and looked at her.
"Does that shock you?"
he asked. It bewildered her, not only what he was saying, but that he was telling her. She didn't know what to say. Like beating Mr. Quillen at horseshoes. This was a distant world.
"Well, you could still be a good person and help people without being a priest," she said.
"I know. Of course you can. But I think a priest can do more. I mean, being a priest carries more weight. People listen to you."
He laughed.
"That's what I always thought, anyway. But you see, my point is, then something like the other day happens, which was wrong, which never should have happened, and that's the terrible dilemma of making mistakes as a priest. It makes it all that much more confusing and burdensome for you. I mean, my actions."
He shook his head with a futile sigh.
"I'm afraid I'm not articulating this very well."
"No, I understand, I do,"
she said, afraid he'd start explaining it all over again. He started to say something, then stopped with a rueful snort.
"You're a good kid, and I appreciate your patience and your understanding."
He patted her shoulder and told her she was too fine a person and too vulnerable right now for anyone to mess up.
"I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for what happened," he said.
"That's okay," she said. "Really?"
"No," he said sadly. He kept looking at her. "No, it's not. Believe me."
He turned suddenly and started the car. He drove slowly, the silence awkward between them. When he pulled into the driveway, she fumbled for the door handle and thanked him for the ride.
"Alice," he said as the door opened.
Then he cleared his throat. Looking back, she was repelled again by his intensity, a rawness pulsating like an exposed nerve. He took her hand.
"Thanks," he said, squeezing so hard her fingers hurt. "Thanks for listening to me."
"Oh, God," she groaned, running up the driveway.
Norm was allowed out of the house to go to work, but he had to come straight home afterward. He still couldn't use the car or the phone or see his friends. He lay on his bed like this in the dark, night after night, his inside shriveled, a mass of pain in the cavity where his heart had been, even swallowing hurt with this constant lump in his throat. Every day a new crop of pimples erupted on his cheeks and the bridge of his nose. With his hands under his head, he listened to the branch scraping back and forth across the screen. Hearing another sound, he sat up and listened. Was someone crying? He
He put his ear to the wall, but his mother's room was silent. Was it Benji? Was it Mrs. Klubach? His stomach turned every time he thought of driving the car over Klubach's dog. He'd tried to get Benji to tell him what had happened, but he wouldn't. Benji could barely look at him. The poor kid had probably felt every crunch and crack under the tires. His last memory that night was Weeb's sister Janice pushing him away as she told him to stop slobbering all over her. He didn't know why his pants were unzipped, and he couldn't even remember driving home. When he asked Benji if there had been any close calls, all he'd said was, "Nope." He was worried about his brother, but if he said anything, the whole mess would be thrown in his face again. Benji was always in the house, either watching television or sleeping. And now that the couch had become Duval's bed, Benji spent most of the night in his room. There it was again. He sat up. It sounded as if Benji was crying. He got out of bed and tapped lightly on his door. Shadows flickered on the stairway wall. Omar was down there laughing at something on television. Benji didn't answer, so he opened the door. Benji was sitting on his dark bed in this niche the previous family had used as a sewing room. There was just space enough for a bed and a small chest of drawers. There was a doorless closet and one narrow window directly over the bed.
"Jesus, Benji, it must be 100 degrees in here."
He knelt on the bed and opened the window. He braced it with a split yardstick from the windowsill. This had been the last sash rope to fray and break. Getting off the bed, he told Benji he still remembered how, when they'd first moved in, every window had stayed open by itself. He knew from Benji's breathing he was trying not to cry.
"I even remember there was a door on that closet, but it wouldn't open with the bed in the room, so me and Mom had to take it off."
He didn't say it, but his most vivid memory of the day they had moved in had been their mother's elation at having their own home, and his sense of power and pride at being the man of the house, carrying boxes and dragging rugs inside with his mother. Funny how these tiny rooms had seemed so enormous then. Benji knelt on the bed. He was trying to close the window.
"What are you doing?" he asked.
"It's that smell. I hate that smell."
Norm sniffed.
"It's just the pig farm. It's not even that bad tonight."
"It makes me feel sick," Benji said, letting the window fall shut.
He locked it, then sat back against the wall and slapped the broken yardstick against the mattress. Norm turned on the light, and Benji squinted in the glare.
"You're scared. Why are you scared?"
"I'm not scared."
Benji stared down at the weathered stick.
"Then why are you up in your room all the time? Why are you acting so creepy lately?"
His chest ached with anger. Why couldn't Benji be as strong as he was? There was nothing and no one to fear, no one but their mother. Benji shrugged.
"Why won't you even look at me? What is it? What the fuck did I do?" he demanded.
Benji kept flipping the yardstick, his features dulled by teary bloat.
"You think I ran over that dog on purpose? You do, don't you?"
he cried, grabbing his brother's wrist and yanking him close. But Benji stared past him.
"I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't. I wouldn't have done that. You know that. I never would have. I know I wouldn't."
The tears running down his brother's face revealed the truth, the vast and horrible truth about himself. He had aimed the car and killed the dog coldly and deliberately, and Benji knew it. He stood up and began to pound his head with his fist.
"Fuck, fuck, fuck, fuck,"
he groaned as Benji sobbed into his pillow. He was going into his room when the television went off. Duval was roaming around downstairs. It was all his fault. The peddler, Norm thought, crawling into bed, because the money he'd gotten drunk on the night he humiliated himself in front of Janice Miller, the night he killed Klubach's dog, probably chasing him, crossing over the grass strip and Klubach's driveway as the dog dove into the lilac bush, that money had come from Duval in a twisted convolution of betrayal and setup. And ever since that night, Duval had been completely in charge here. Duval was calling the shots with everyone just where he wanted them. He closed his eyes. Duval was pulling the strings, making them all dance faster and faster. His heart began to race. And now, through the hollow wall between the rooms, there came that thin cry, that gasping again. He rolled over and listened in astonishment. That's what he'd heard before. That's what he'd walked in on.
Jesus Christ! His little brother hadn't been crying, but going at it full throttle. Imagine that!
He pulled the pillow over his head to muffle the last pathetic groan.
That bastard Duval.
It was all his fault. Everything. On Friday morning, when Alice got up, Benji told her that Father Gannon had called earlier. He'd said not to wake her up, just give her a message. He was going to be in Proctor late tonight helping Father Krestecki stack firewood, and he'd stop by the A+X and give her a ride home from work. She was mad at Benji for not waking her up, and mad at Father Gannon for being so nervy. But then by the end of the long, hot night, was too tired to care anymore. Father Gannon arrived the minute the lights went out. He waited while she finished her closing chores. She saw Blue Mooney peer down into the Monsignor's car on his way into the kitchen. She began to hang the clean pots over the grill. Mooney was telling Fawny Anuta about a fight he'd had earlier this evening with two creeps who thought he'd tried to cut them off the road. His voice rose, and she realized the story was really for her benefit. Now he was bragging about some job he was trying to get. He'd be driving a truck. Far from here, she hoped. Father Gannon grinned when she got into the car. As he drove, he told her how Father Krestecki was clearing the lot behind the rectory himself so that a new parking lot could be paved. Whenever he could, Father Gannon went out there to help him split and stack the wood.
What a workout, he sighed.
Sounds like it, she said, both yawning and rubbing her nose against the sharp smell of sweat. He slowed down as he approached her street.
You're tired, huh?
Yeah, I am. I really am. They'd been busy all night, and she couldn't wait to go to bed.
Here we are, he said, turning into the driveway. Well, that didn't take long.
Something in his voice made her think of that dark rectory, the only sound the Monsignor clearing his throat, grunting and sneezing the way he did all through Mass. Before she could close the door, he leaned across the seat to say he'd be coming back from Proctor this same time tomorrow if she needed a ride. At 11 o'clock Saturday night, it was still 80 degrees, with the temperature in the A+X kitchen at least 100 degrees. They had been too busy all night for anyone to take breaks. Even Blue Mooney had been put to work on the grill with Anthology, who bullied him and laughed every time his cousin made a mistake. Mooney was rolling a trash barrel through the lot when Father Gannon pulled in. Alice saw him lean into the priest's window to tell him they were closed. Father Gannon gestured toward the building. Mooney pointed toward the street and said something. When Father Gannon started to back up, she ran outside. "He can wait here," she said.
"Well, I just didn't want people thinking we're open," Mooney said, his face reddening. "I can wait out here. That's no problem."
Father Gannon started to shift again. "No," she insisted, surprised at how angry she felt. "You wait right here, Father. I'll be done in a few minutes, and no one's going to think we're open," she said, glaring at Mooney.
"Father," Mooney said, on her heels, heading toward the kitchen. "What do you mean, father? Like someone's father, father?"
"He's a priest," she said, even more annoyed by his relieved grin. Instead of his collar, Father Gannon wore a soiled dark blue shirt. He apologized for his appearance, the bits of bark on his shoulder and even in his hair. He and Father Krestecki had been splitting wood since supper time. When they finished, they'd collapsed on the back porch, both so thirsty that Father Gannon said they'd each down 3 beers, one after another. Something went cold and tight inside. 3 beers. She kept glancing at him, but he seemed perfectly normal. Definitely more relaxed, if not a little silly. He was laughing now because he had early Mass tomorrow, and he still hadn't prepared his sermon. "So what are you going to do?" she asked, yawning.
"Actually, I was thinking I'd work on it now if you don't mind riding around a while."
He looked at her and smiled.
"I've kind of got the gist of it."
"Oh, okay, sure," she said, trying not to show her exasperation. She was so exhausted she could barely keep her eyes open, and now she had to listen to a midnight homily. He hunched over the wheel and cleared his throat loudly. He drove down Main Street. In the moonlight, the marble church glowed a ghostly white. He passed her corner.
"My sermon today is about value and redemption," he began. "Now, I know not everyone collects the same kind of stamps, but you probably all have the same difficulties when it comes to redemption."
Her eyes closed, her head bobbed as she dozed, lulled by the drone of his voice and the car's engine. She dreamed she was in a store filled with feathered hats, bright silk dresses, and soft leather shoes. Her arms ached from carrying all the beautiful clothes she wanted to buy if only she could find a cashier. She staggered up and down the aisles, but there was no one to help her. Finally, she saw a tiny woman standing by a cash register at the front door. The woman, who was no bigger than a child, kept shaking her head as she piled the clothes onto the counter.
"You're just wasting your time," the woman said.
"Alice," Father Gannon was nudging her arm.
"Alice, wake up. You're home."
She stared at him. Her eyes were burning, her thoughts raced. She was home. The woman would only take green stamps, and Father Gannon had just been saying there weren't enough redemption centers.
"Are you awake?"
"Yes."
"Boy, that was record time. You were sound asleep 2 sentences into my sermon."
She tried to explain how tired she was and what a long day it had been, but that it had been a wonderful sermon, really. And now he was laughing so hard he could barely speak.
"I was only kidding," he finally managed to say. "I was talking about saving green stamps. It was a joke."
He turned so instantly somber that she thought he might be angry.
"I was trying to be funny," he said with a self-conscious laugh.
He kept looking at her as if he needed to say something. She could feel him watching her as she hurried down the driveway. She lay in bed for a long time, unable to sleep. She kept thinking of him saying her name. "Alice, wake up, Alice," over and over. "Alice, Alice," with his hand on her arm. By the end of the next night, she kept glancing up at the clock. She was in the supply room when Mr. Coughlin limped out of Carla's car on crutches. Carla had driven him to the hospital where they'd been for the last hour. Earlier in the evening, one of Carla's customers had driven off with a tray attached to his car, an oversight that always enraged Mr. Coughlin. While he and Carla were screaming at each other, he reared back and kicked the side of the building. His big toe was broken. Mooney came to the door.
"That same guy's here, that priest," he said.
She looked out and waved. Father Gannon raised a hand to tell her to take her time. She could feel Mooney watching as she jammed the last dispenser with napkins and wedged it onto the full tray. Before she could pick it up, he had the heavy tray balanced on his fingertips. The muscle in his arm bulged his American flag tattoo in and out.
"Is he a relative or something?"
he asked, holding the door open with his foot.
"No, he's just a friend," she said, surprising herself.
"That's weird,"
Mooney said under his breath.
"That's really weird."
Father Gannon's clerical collar glowed under the passing street lamps. He hadn't been able to help Father Krzyzewski with the wood because he'd been at the nursing home all night with an old woman who was dying. Her family, who lived in California, had asked the Monsignor to be there, but his gallbladder had kicked up.
"Did she die?"
Alice asked uneasily.
"No," he sighed. "As a matter of fact, she was having some broth when I left."
Somehow, though, she didn't believe him. He seemed too nervous. He kept sighing and rubbing his chin. The woman had died, and she, Alice, was the tail end of a death mission. When he turned at her corner, she was surprised at her disappointment. Lately, it seemed she was always either working or getting ready for work.
"Tired, huh?" he asked.
"Not really. I had coffee right before I left so I wouldn't fall asleep."
"You did?"
He smiled at her.
"How about a little ride, then?"
"Oh, a ride's fine," she said, and he headed back toward Main Street.
"I hope the coffee doesn't keep you up all night," he said.
"That's one good thing about this job. I can sleep late in the morning."
He groaned with envy and said he had the early mass. Feeling guilty, she pointed to the stop sign ahead and told him if he turned right, then he'd be back by her street.
"It's okay."
He laughed and said he hadn't been sleeping too well lately.
"This is good, getting out like this, especially with someone under the age of 40. God," he added, 30.
20,
she said in a small voice, and he laughed.
"That's even better," he said,
and he laughed again. They seemed to be following the moon as they drove into the hills. The pastures looked wet in the moonlight, the trees of the bordering woods dense with shadows. The houses they passed were dark and still. In all this way, they had only seen a single car, the one that seemed to be aiming straight at them on this narrow, winding road. Father Gannon jerked the wheel, pulling onto the soft shoulder to let it by. In the last few minutes, they had been matching mother's stories, holes in socks, burned toast, and for some reason, tears, right before Sunday Mass.
He pulled back onto the road.
Maybe all mothers do it, he said. They just get so exhausted trying to get everything to go right.
Well, I won't, she said so sharply that he looked at her.
Won't what? He asked. Go to church?
Not if it means getting everyone all upset. Actually, she hadn't meant that until she'd seen the look on his face. This was the same thing she'd done to Lester. She'd enjoyed shocking him. But Lester's reaction had always been so pained and personal, while Father Gannon seemed amused. I mean, she continued, you go to Mass to be close to God, but when the whole time you're sitting there a nervous wreck and you can't concentrate on one single word the priest is saying, much less pray yourself, so what's the point? I mean, wouldn't it be better to just stay home and be quiet and calm and filled with good feelings instead of worrying what everyone around you is thinking? Her voice had gone too high. He glanced at her.
Is that a question?
Yes. Really, I mean it. She took a deep breath, uneasy with his silence.
I don't know, he finally said. I guess it's the good feelings part. You can get good feelings from a lot of things, right? A big juicy steak, a funny movie, being with someone you really like.
He shrugged.
I don't know. I don't think that's quite the commitment Christ had in mind.
She looked out the window.
Do you?
He asked after a moment when she still hadn't replied. I don't know. She felt young and stupid. She watched the fence along the road, its barbed wire glittering as they passed.
No, tell me. Tell me what you think, he insisted.
She looked at him, shocked by what she was thinking and feeling right now.
You meant what you were saying. Why won't you explain it? Why won't you tell me?
I don't know. I guess I was just sounding off or something. I don't know.
You can't talk to me, he sighed. I make you feel uncomfortable, don't I?
No, it's not that. I don't know. I'm just starting to feel really tired, for one thing. I think my coffee's wearing off, and gosh, it's really getting late, she said, studying the moon as if it were the bright face of a clock. You'll never get up in time for the 6.
I can turn here, he said, pulling onto the soft shoulder.
He sat so still, staring over the wheel, that she thought something was wrong with the car, or maybe with him. He spoke suddenly, in a faltering voice.
Alice, I've got this terrible feeling, this awful pain like an ache that goes from here, he said, gesturing at his throat, right down to my stomach.
And then for a moment he didn't say anything. Maybe you should see a doctor, she said hesitantly.
That wouldn't do any good, he said with a long sigh.
He turned and looked at her.
Besides, all the doctors I've seen don't want to hear what's really wrong.
In the uneasy silence, she began to twist the apron string around her wrist, binding it tighter and tighter. What's that? She asked, though she already knew.
I just want to touch you. That's all I want. That's all I think of every minute all day long. And now here I am right next to you, and I can't, because I'm not supposed to. Because it's wrong, because of who I am, because you're young, because you might not even want me to.
She unwound the apron string, pulling it up into the air. Her mouth was dry. She kept swallowing. She heard his breathing quicken.
Alice, do you know what I'm talking about? Do you?
She looked up and nodded.
Tell me what to do, he whispered. Is it all right?
She closed her eyes as he moved toward her.
Oh, you sweet girl, he kept whispering. You sweet, sweet girl.
His entire body was trembling. His hands shook as they touched her face. She told her mother she was getting rides home with different girls from work. Night after night he was there, always on time, freshly shaven, cheeks slapped pink with spicy cologne, glowing when she appeared, grinning at her so often that he was always swerving away from parked cars, from oncoming cars, jerking the wheel back into the lane. She rode gripping the door handle. He wore a white T-shirt, his black clerical pants, black shoes. His Roman collar and black shirt were in the glove compartment. The Monsignor was at Lake George with the Hines family these last few days, and there was a visiting priest helping out, so he could come and go as he pleased. Mrs. Arkaday went to bed early, and he always left a note on his door, telling when he'd return, in case there were any sick calls. Even if there had been anything open this late at night, they really couldn't be seen together in public, so they would drive around and talk. Then, right before it was time to bring her home, He would stop on a back road and move across the long, deep seat to take her in his arms. He no longer trembled, but now his apprehension had taken the form of apology. Her back was against the door handle. He was sorry. She was rubbing her chin. Had he hurt her mouth? Was it too hot in here for her? Too cool? Too buggy? Was he too heavy? His hands too rough? His embrace too desperate? He was so afraid of hurting her, he said, afraid of forcing himself in any way on her.
Just tell me to stop,
he whispered at her wet ear,
and I will. That's all you have to do,
he panted. The choice was hers. He was kissing her throat, her shoulder. Eyes closed, she shook her head, panting herself. Don't talk, she wanted to say. His breathing was enough, his lungs, his heart against hers. The sound of his voice, his groaning, stirred her, blinded and deafened her. Words ruined it. Words turned them back into Alice Vermoyle and Father Gannon, both in uniform, in the Monsignor's car, on a dark road, dense with brambles and guilt.
I'll do anything, anything you want,
he pleaded at her breast. She shook her head, her bra dangling loose.
Tell me, please tell me.
Her eyes opened. Where were they? Was that a car coming? She raised her head to see, and he writhed with a sudden motion. She slid across the seat, half onto the floor. He was pulling down her pants, and then she helped him with his.
My God, he groaned when she held him. Oh, my God, I'll do anything for you, anything,
he cried with the anguished fervor of prayer. She pushed away and got back up on the seat. No, she whispered, pulling up her pants and reaching back awkwardly to hook her bra.
I'm sorry. I hurt you, didn't I?
He reached to touch her, then drew back.
It's all too fast, isn't it? I'm sorry.
He covered his eyes.
I don't know what I'm thinking of. You're so young. My God, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, Alice.
It was all right, she kept trying to tell him. She had gotten scared, that was all, afraid that someone might drive by and see them. She couldn't explain it, but what she feared was this presence she felt, this sense of all that was between them. She said it again. I guess I just panicked, that's all.
Oh, God. I've got to be careful, he said, buttoning her shirt front as if she were a child.
He straightened her collar and smoothed back her hair.
I won't let anything hurt you. I promise.
As much as she believed him, she was still afraid. Norm sat up in bed when he heard Duval's car pull in. For the last 2 hours, his mother had been pacing from room to room and up and down the stairs. At one point, she had gotten into her car and roared off down the street, only to peel into the driveway soon after, slamming the car door, the back door, cupboard doors, as if doors both fueled and exercised her rage. He knew better than to offer to help or ask what the problem was. You, she would say. You are the problem. You are the cause of all my pain. Once my pride and my hope, you are now my greatest disappointment. He was through battling with her. She was too shrewd, too quick to attack, and she was inexhaustible. And yet, with Duval, she continued to be so passive, so gullible, that it was not only bewildering, but lately frightening. It was 1:30, and Duval was just getting back. Alice had arrived a while before with some lame story about going to a girl's house after work. Her mother might believe it, but he didn't. Whoever was driving Alice home was dropping her off at the corner. He'd look out the window and see his sister hurrying down the shadowy street, and he'd be filled with rage, wondering who the son of a bitch was who couldn't even see her safely home. She denied it, but he was certain it was Lester. The fag probably had some weird rule about driving down a dead-end street after midnight. Duval came in the back door. Norm tiptoed to the top of the stairs.
"You said you'd be here by 8:00,
came his mother's clipped voice as the light went on down in the kitchen. Glasses clinked. The refrigerator door squealed open.
I know, Duval sighed. I just got further and further behind with every appointment.
You could have called.
I should have.
The refrigerator door opened again.
You're right. I should have.
Footsteps. A drawer opened. The silverware drawer rattled open.
You look tired, Marie.
Duval was talking with food in his mouth, probably eating cold spaghetti. Leering at her while he chewed, red sauce on his lips. The pig. The disgusting pig.
I feel as if everything's starting to cave in on me. The first payment's due. It's all going crazy with the kids. I can't think straight at work. Mr. Briscoe's always on my back. What's wrong, he keeps saying, as if I knew, as if I could tell him.
You're just tired.
Duval said over a clinking fork.
No. No, I can feel it. Something's going to happen. It's like this big thing that keeps swelling up around me, and then you say you'll be here no later than 8, so I count on that. I need that. Do you understand?
Yes, I do.
Duval sighed.
I most certainly do.
There's something wrong, isn't there? I can tell,
she said, her voice rising. Duval insisted there was nothing wrong. She insisted there was.
Get him,
Norm said under his breath. He leaned over the railing. They were still in the kitchen. Their long shadows faced each other on the living room wall at the bottom of the stairs.
I am just not accustomed to accounting for every waking moment of my day,
Duval said. He tensed with the abrupt silence. Okay, now, Duval was finally going to get his ass kicked right through that front door, and if he said one word to her, one word...
Of course you're not. I'm sorry, Omar. I'm so sorry.
He threw up his hands in disbelief. Jesus Christ, that was her chance. Duval sighed.
You see, it's hard, Marie. Hard being around a woman you... I don't know how to put this, but it's being here all the time and never being able to... You see... Aside from being a very busy man right now, Marie, I'm a loving man, a robust man with a healthy appetite, and you can't expect me to sit here night after night aching with desire. So I try to keep busy, keep my mind off of those kind of things, if you know what I mean.
That asshole, he groaned.
You're a good Christian woman, Marie,
Duval continued in a pained voice,
and I know you've been hurt. But there has to be more between a man and a woman than a peck on the lips and laying side by side. Comes a time when it just ain't natural,
he said with a bawdy laugh that enraged Norm. Her reply was indistinct and small with apology. Duval was whispering. He could hear a window being closed, the click of a light switch, her flat shoes scuffed grittily along the floor toward the living room. He stiffened back. She wasn't going to bring him up here to her bed, was she? And she couldn't very well do it right out in the open down there on the couch. A chair scraped out from the table.
Come here,
Duval coaxed through the darkened kitchen.
Come on now. Oh,
he sighed.
You are light as a feather, just as soft as fluff.
He waited until he couldn't stand it another moment. Then he came down the stairs. When he turned on the lamp in the living room, they pulled apart. She started to get up from Duval's lap, but he held her there.
What do you want?
She said as Norm went to the refrigerator.
I'm hungry,
he said, taking ice cream from the freezer. Behind him, he heard her trying to struggle free of Duval.
Let her go, you asshole,
he said, turning, wielding the quart box like a brick.
I said,
Norm,
she cried, then burst into tears. She ran into the bathroom.
Now look what you've done,
Duval said, coming toward him.
Your mother's a good woman, and she deserves better than that. Come on, come on!
He held up his fists, but Duval just shook his head, chuckling as he went past him to the bathroom door, where he called in softly to tell Marie he thought it best to leave now. He'd call her tomorrow. Norm hugged the pillow over his head so he wouldn't have to hear his mother crying. Marie's day had started badly. Alice had come in late last night, her cheeks raw with whisker burns, while she continued to insist she had been hanging out with a bunch of girls from work. Instead of being contrite for his behavior last night, Norm had announced at breakfast that he wasn't going to spend the rest of his summer grounded. He intended to go out that night. Actually, she'd been relieved. It would mean a little more privacy in the house for herself and Omar. But then, right before she'd left for work, Omar had come by to tell her his good news. Claire Mayo had agreed to give him his room back in the boarding house.
She thinks she's so shrewd, but I know,
he said, laughing.
She figures by keeping track of me, she can keep track of her sister May's franchise investment.
She watched him take his razor and shaving cream from the back of the toilet.
But you can stay here. You know I want you to, she said.
I know that, but it'll be better, Marie, just for a time. Alice is staying away more and more. Norm and I could go to the mat any moment, you know that. And Benji, my lord, I worry about that boy. I think he needs his mother right now.
No, what he needs is a man in his life.
Her fierce stare held his bright eyes.
Maybe, but not me, not right now. I seem to be the agitating factor in this whole situation, and so I'll remove myself. but just for a time.
He took her chin and lowered his face to hers.
I'll still be coming down that driveway right about supper time. I just won't be cluttering things up for a time, for the children, Marie.
For a time. She kept repeating the words, for a time. She had lost control these last few weeks. She would get it back. She would be just as strong, just as tough as she used to be, and she would get her life and her children back on track. So when Mr. Briscoe offered to take Benji fishing the following Sunday, she accepted gratefully. All week long, whenever she reminded Benji of his fishing date, he'd mutter, "I'm not going," and she'd growl back, "Oh, yes, you are." Mr. Briscoe arrived early Sunday morning, laden with poles, tackle boxes, and bait. He was wearing a wide-brimmed canvas hat with feathery lures tucked into the leather band. Benji would be right out, she said, through a hard smile. He offered to wait in the car, and she could tell he was disappointed when she agreed. Benji was in the bathroom. "I'm not going," he said at the other side of the locked door. "You have to. He's out there. He's waiting. Tell him I'm sick." "You're not sick." "I'm going to throw up," he gagged. "God damn you, Benji, open this door." "I can't," he moaned. "I'm throwing up." The retching intensified. "You're not sick, you're afraid. You can't do this. You've got to go." "I'm sick." "Open this goddamn door or I'll smash it open," she cried, beating it with her fists and kicking it. The hollow door banged against the frame. Benji's gagging grew louder. Mr. Briscoe's car idled in the driveway. "Benji, how can you do this to me? That's my boss out there. Don't you understand? He's out there waiting." The bones in her hands throbbed. "Mom, stop it! Stop it!" Alice cried, pulling her away as Norm hurtled down the stairs in his underwear.
"Jesus Christ," he said, then raced to the door and told Benji to come out.
"Make him go."
"I'll tell him Benji's sick," he said, starting for the front door.
"No,"
she said. That wasn't what she meant. She couldn't lift her head. Here it was, all over again, the never-ending chain of weakness and failure.
"You make Benji go with him."
"He's sick, Mom." She looked up now.
"Don't you understand? He needs to go. He has to."
"No, Mom, not like this. You can't make him. You can't."
"Yes, I can and I will," she said, pushing past their reaching hands. "Benji, you open this door."
It opened, and on the floor, Benji sagged against the spattered toilet bowl. The smell of sickness spewed out of the damp little bathroom. His skin was white, and there were circles under his eyes. She burst into tears.
"Now what do I do?" she sobbed. "I don't know what to do."
"I'll go," Norm was saying. He ran upstairs to put on his pants, then ran back down, carrying his sneakers. "Me and Mr. Briscoe will have a good time. Everything's going to be all right, Mom. You'll see," he said at the door.
Here in the middle of the lake, soft breezes undulated their drifting lines. Waves stirred by distant boats slapped the sides of Mr. Briscoe's dinghy. Mr. Briscoe had packed ham and cheese sandwiches. There were crunchy dill pickles and hard-boiled eggs, peanuts, potato chips, cupcakes, and ice-cold sodas. Out here, everything was different. The food tasted great, and Mr. Briscoe wasn't half the creep Norm had always thought he was.
"This is the life, isn't it, Norm?"
Mr. Briscoe sighed again. He stretched back in the boat, arms under his head, his hat brim covering his eyes, his white legs crossed at the ankles.
"Sure is," Norm sighed, squinting back at the crowded green haze of the shore. "Keeps me sane."
"Fishing?" he asked, the conversational shorthand more natural as the day wore on.
"Not even. The daydreaming."
"Yeah?"
"Sometimes things get too much. I put my head down on the desk and see myself out here just floating along, not a care in the world, not a one."
"Yeah," he said, eyes closed, his face and bare chest baking in the sun.
"Too bad about Benji," Mr. Briscoe said.
"He'll get over it."
"I know how it is."
"Probably the grip or something."
"I mean, his problems."
Norm opened one eye into the searing sun. He clenched the oarlock. The asshole was still an asshole.
"What problems?" "Well, you see, Norm, I caught Benji taking something from the store. I told him it would be our little secret. I promised him."
He sat up, shielding his eyes.
"Then how come you're telling me?"
because I know how it is for a boy, how hard it can get and how much it can hurt. A boy needs a man in his life.
He reached out to touch Norm's knee.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, he said, moving so that Briscoe's hand fell away. He felt drained by the ease of Mr. Briscoe's familiarity.
Just try to be the man in your brother's life, Norm. He needs that. And don't say anything to your mother about the glove. I've been really worried about her lately. Really worried.
Suddenly the air glittered with sunlit spray as they heaved back and forth in the wake of a speedboat skimming past. Norm gripped the seat, feeling puny and naked. He had been the man in his brother's and his mother's life, until Duval. Benji sat stiffly in Mr. Tuck's living room. A cat jumped onto his lap and rubbed her back against him. Mr. Tuck's little girls peered through the glass door. The taller child with the long sausage curls was making faces at him. Her younger sister giggled and held herself as if she had to go to the bathroom. Mr. Tuck had taken the afternoon off. He was all dressed up in his best suit, his only suit, the one he wore during the school year. He didn't own a summer suit. All he needed at the swimming pool was a T-shirt and bathing suit. He came down the stairs, annoyed to see his daughters giggling at his first patient. Two quick whacks on their bottom sent them howling through the house. He lifted the cat by the scruff of its neck and threw it out the door. He sat down across from the boy and tried to appear thoughtful, as if preoccupied with an earlier patient. This took the form of a scowl. He was grateful to his wife's uncle, Ferdinand Briscoe, for this opportunity. It might be the beginning of everything, he'd told Grace in bed last night, sending away for college catalogs for seniors and setting up class schedules for terrified freshmen was not enough. Who knows, he'd sighed to his wife. After the Fermoil kid, there just might be an avalanche of parents bringing their troubled offspring to his door for counseling. Exhausted, he steadied his frown on Benji. He'd been up half the night figuring out how much of the house expenses, including the mortgage, would be tax-deductible if he used the living room as his office. 1/6 of everything would amount to quite a savings. Benji kept swallowing and trying hard not to blink. "Look him right in the eye," his mother had said, "and answer his questions, except if you think he's just being nosy about my private life or something like that, because, after all, don't forget, he is Mr. Briscoe's nephew." With so many secrets, this was going to be tricky. Mr. Tuck was trying to light a pipe. He sucked at the stem, frowning when he couldn't get it lit. Mrs. Tuck came to the door and glared through the glass. Her daughters were still screaming. Mr. Tuck smiled sheepishly as his wife opened the door. The cat ran inside and jumped into Benji's lap. "That wasn't necessary," Mrs. Tuck hissed. "This is a private session, Grace," he snapped. She wiped her hands on her apron. "It's a fine turn of events, David Tuck, when your own children have to be beaten so that you can help some stranger's child." She slammed the door. Mr. Tuck's stomach burned. He hadn't even begun, and it was falling apart. He looked back at the boy stroking the cat. It wasn't going to be easy. He would have to partition off that door from the rest of the house to keep his family life from interfering with his professional life.
"Well, Benjamin, where should we begin?"
The boy's stare made him nervous.
"At the beginning, I guess. Let's see, you don't have any friends, you're scared of water, and let me think now, there was something about a dog. Give me a minute now, it'll come to me."
His laugh was meant to relax the boy, but it came out high and cackly. The frown slipped back over his face. He felt himself blush.
"I know. You saw a dog get hit by a car. Am I right, Benny?"
"No, sir. I didn't see the car hit him. I just felt it."
"Hmm. Now, was this your dog? I think your mother said you and the dog were close."
"No, he was the Clue Box dog from next door."
"I see,"
Tuck said, flipping through a notepad for a clean page. Damn, he should have been making notes from the beginning. This would go in the boy's record, in his file. He would need file cabinets. The girl's piano would have to be moved into the den. Another battle with Grace. He glanced up, pen poised.
"Do you know what today's date is?"
"No."
"Well, anyway, you were in this car, and the driver's intoxicated."
He looked up from his notes.
"Now, it's your father that drinks, right?"
"Sometimes."
"So it's late at night, and you're in the car, and you don't see the dog, but the car hits the dog. Have we got that right so far?"
"Well, the car ran over the dog. It didn't just hit him. You know, the wheels, they went over him."
"The wheels, they went over him. Okay,
Good. Now, tell me what happened next.
I don't remember. I'm not sure.
You don't remember. You're not sure, he said, pen scratching as he recorded the boy's every word.
Well, what did you say?
I don't remember what I said.
You must have said something. Try to remember. Maybe you said, oh my God, or shit. I mean, under the circumstances, that would certainly be acceptable, don't you think?
He chuckled to loosen the boy up.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, what did you say?
He asked, pen poised. I don't know. Probably I didn't say anything. I was pretty upset.
Is that what you do when you're upset, Benny? You go silent?
Yeah, the boy shrugged. I guess. Sometimes.
What about your father? What did he say?
He didn't say anything. He wasn't there.
You mean, in a manner of speaking, not there?
No, he's in a hospital.
Oh, I didn't realize he'd been injured. No wonder. Oh, my heavens.
No, he's in a hospital for drinking. He wasn't in the car that night.
He blinked.
My brother was.
I see,
Tuck said with a skeptical glance. Classic case of denial, he thought. He continued writing. Benny and brother in car. He looked up.
Now, your mother says you're so upset, so haunted by this tragedy, that you won't leave the house, that it's all you think about.
It's not all I think about. I try and think of other things.
Are you sublimating your grief, son?
He asked. He'd done some reading in his old textbooks last night.
I don't know what that word means. He tried to light the pipe again.
Of course you don't.
He coughed.
This is your first encounter with psychiatry, isn't it?
He waved away the smoke between them.
I guess so.
The boy kept looking toward the door. Tuck sensed that he was homing in on something here. Better not seem too eager, though. Take it slow and easy.
What that means, Benny.
Do you mind if I call you Benny?
Benjamin's such a mouthful.
No, sir. I don't mind if you want to.
What that word means is that you're hiding your true feelings. That you are pretending the accident never happened.
He paused.
Is that what you're doing, Benny?
He asked softly.
I know it happened. The boy shrugged. I just try and make it seem different.
The cat purred loudly as he stroked it.
How do you do that, son?
Maybe the cat would be a good idea after all, an innovative technique to relax his patients. The cat food would definitely be deductible. Grace would have to start saving the grocery slips.
I just think about it like it was a program I saw, or a movie or something.
That's sublimation, Benny,
he said, checking his notes. There was still the fear of water to cover, and no friends. There was a tap on the door. Tuck looked up to see his daughter crossing her eyes and sticking out her tongue at his patient. He threw open the door.
Don't you ever do this again,
he said, grabbing her arm and shaking her.
Mommy says it's lunchtime and she's not going to wait around all day, so he has to go now because Mommy said so,
his daughter screamed. Tuck released her, and seeing the print of his grip red on her flesh, felt dizzy. He tried to pull her close to soothe her, but she ran off shrieking to her mother. He closed the door quickly. He didn't know what it was lately about his older child. Something about her was driving him to these frenzies. He felt the boy's eyes on him, and he was ashamed. Last winter, she'd spilled milk in his lap. In his anger, he'd dislocated her shoulder. They told Dr. Lawson that she'd fallen down the cellar stairs. For months afterward, she had had such terrible nightmares that Grace had to sleep with her. It was only 2 weeks ago that Grace had moved back into their bedroom. Since then, she'd let him make love to her once, the whole time, hushing him while she listened for her daughter's cry. He bent over the boy, speaking rapidly, to fit it all in before the explosion.
Now remember, Benny, don't sublimate. What happened, happened. Talk about it to people.
The door opened, her mouth twisted.
You make me sick, you hypocrite!
He hurried toward her with both hands raised in supplication.
Please, Grace, not now. Wait until he leaves, I beg you.
Tell him to get out now, she demanded, shaking her fist. I want him out now.
Benji jumped up with the clinging cat's claws embedded in his chest as he headed for the door. Tuck wavered, glancing between his wife and his patient.
Tell your mother that'll be a dollar, Benny, and I'll call her to set up the next session, he called.
No, Mrs. Tuck was hollering. There'll be no more of your little sessions, you hypocrite, you monster.
The door slammed, and the cat leaped onto the porch, and then Benji heard a sound like a woman crying as if she was in pain, as if Mr. Tuck had punched her in the mouth or something. He ran down the steps and up the street. The little room off the rectory parlor was a warm gray fizz of television static. Mrs. Arkaday dozed in the green leather chair, her feet on the hassock, arms crossed. Her head bobbed with a drooling smile as she dreamed of Howard waving at her through the glass.
"This is the end of our evening programming."
Her eyes shot open, and for a moment she couldn't stop trembling as she stared at the sputtering test pattern on the screen. She was exhausted after supervising Howard Menka's window washing all day. Every time she tapped on the glass to point to a spot, he glared at her. One of these days he was going to haul off and hit someone, and what would the Monsignor do then? Whose responsibility would that be? Poor man, he certainly had his hands full, people always pestering him with their problems. Now it was his cousins, the Hineses, and their dying son, when he had so much to run, rectory, church, school, and on top of it now, this strange new priest, prowling up and down the back stairway in his stocking feet all hours of the day and night, on his way God knows where. He hadn't worn his shoes inside since the polish fiasco. There were still streaks in the carpeting, and now every room smelled of his feet.
"Father Gannon!"
the Monsignor would shout, bearing down on her.
"Where's Father Gannon?"
As if she should know, as if she had any say at all about what went on here. Good thing, too, because if she did, the first thing she'd do would be to fire Howard Menka, and then the next, she'd show